Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're dusting off a morning show interview that has not been heard since its initial broadcast way back in 2002. It's with Gus Rousseau, who for many years was a filmmaker, first for PBS's Frontline and then for ABC News's Special Reports with Peter Jennings, before turning his talents and time towards writing fascinating books like this one, a book called The Outfit: The Role of Chicago's Underworld in the Shaping of Modern America. The Outfit was the nickname for one of Chicago's most influential and infamous organized crime cartels, which was a mover and shaker behind the scenes for more than 60 years. Gus Rousseau's book is published by Bloomsbury.
First of all, Mr. Rousseau, tell us how this topic came across your bow.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I wasn't enamored of organized crime, as a lot of people, you know, have a hobby of following that. I didn't grow up interested in it necessarily, but I was doing these programs, documentary television, as we were talking about. I was involved with maybe a dozen, 15 or 20 different shows, I don't know, over the years, mostly concerning the history of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which I grew up in. And whether I was doing a thing on Nixon or Kennedy or Marilyn Monroe or Las Vegas, you name it, what really struck me was this: there was a handful of names that kept occurring throughout, a thread, and those names were all Chicago gangsters, because they were involved with Hollywood, they were involved with Las Vegas, they were involved with Kennedy, with Nixon. And, you know, it just struck me, okay, enough's enough. Somebody should sit down and write their story, because they seem to be involved in everything.
In everybody else's story.
Exactly.
Huh. How far back does that history go? I don't mean so much I don't know, maybe your book does take us back to the very beginning, but do we have even a very clear idea? Is it possible to know just when organized crime emerged in Chicago?
I felt I had to go way back in time to actually the incorporation of the city, because I wanted to understand for myself why it happened there to that degree. And so there's a long prologue in the book that talks about why Chicago, and it has to do with the fact that when Chicago was a number of reasons, but most of all, when Chicago was incorporated in the 1800s, for some reason they forgot to include a police department in the landscape of the city, and so what happened, crime immediately went out of control. And gangsters from around the region, in fact, around the country, started to gravitate to this city with no police department. Eventually, of course, they had a police department. By that time, the gangsters were in control of everything, including the cops. And they never let go. At least for about 100 years, they didn't.
Wow.
So that's why it happened. They were under-legislated in terms of, officialdom.
You've already, in effect, answered the other question that comes to mind, which is, does Chicago have an organized crime legacy that surpasses that of other major cities, or is it just one more place where organized crime has existed, or is this where it has happened to an unprecedented degree?
I think Chicago does surpass the other cities for that reason. It was a couple of things. It was the lack of an effective police department combined with the unique geography of the city, being the last sort of civilized town in the 1800s before the frontier. So you had all these adventurers and people coming through, mostly men coming through to blaze the trail into the frontier, who would stop in Chicago for their last big fling before hitting the West. And so you had, you know, saloons, bars, gambling, vice, and no police. So that was, it all added together to form this incredibly colorful city, shall we say.
Colorful would be a charitable way of putting it, probably. So this has really been a part of Chicago's landscape from the very, very beginning.
Exactly.
We should probably retreat back for just a second and try to clarify for people what we mean when we talk about organized crime. I mean, I think a lot of it is embodied by the term itself. But tell us what exactly you mean and what most people mean when they refer to organized crime.
Well, I would define organized crime to mean a group of lawbreakers who work together in concert for a common goal with a leader, an either elected or chosen leader, and a board of people who work under him, with many tiers below the leader, with the predominant theme being to make as much off the books money as possible. Most of organized crime is involved in making money. It's not about crime for crime's sake or evil for evil's sake. The ultimate goal is to make money, and unreported money to the IRS. And so when you have people who try to do it in some organized fashion and coordinate their efforts, I would think that would be the definition of organized crime.
Hmm. Is it something that was very much known to the general public? Or to what extent was organized crime in Chicago hidden away from public awareness?
Oh, I think in places like Chicago, it was pretty well known. You know, it was well tolerated in some quarters. It was considered just a topic of conversation because these guys were like romantic, colorful, and they tried to be Robin Hoods in some areas, rob from the rich and give to the poor. Certainly, when Prohibition came in, the gangs were much more upfront and well known to the public because they were peddling the booze during the 20s, and this was no secret at all from anybody. And here again, the public, much of the public anyway, was enamored of these men because they gave jobs to the poor. A lot of immigrants who otherwise wouldn't have jobs were now employed. So they were sort of, like I said, Robin Hoods or romantic heroes, at least in the immigrant ghettos. So it was fairly well known, especially by Prohibition.
What sort of factions are we talking about at any given time in the history of organized crime? Would we have two powerful sectors, 3, 4, 10, 12? What are we talking about? How complicated a picture?
Well, in terms of my book, The Outfit, what I'm talking about is the gang that was centered in Chicago, obviously, but had a much longer reach. Their influence spread west, almost the rest of the west of the country, west of Chicago. And the other predominant large gang was the New York gang, sometimes known as the Commission, which took care of organized crime business in the Northeast. And those are the two fundamentally predominant large interstate gangs. Certainly every area has its own, you know, local thugs and so forth. But as far as the big operators, what you really had was two. You had Chicago and New York, and it's fairly well concluded that Chicago was much more effective than New York.
Interesting. So in Chicago, there was, at any given point, one kingpin of Chicago organized crime, and there was not a lot going on in the terms of warring factions sort of struggling for control.
There was a time when there was warfare. Certainly during the bootlegging era in the 20s, there was a few years of gangs trying to supersede the gang that eventually became the Outfit, which was Al Capone's syndicate. There was a fair bit of bloodletting during the 20s, and Capone's people prevailed, and that was through the infamous St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929. Once that eliminated the competition, from then on it was clear sailing.
Hmm. When did the term the Outfit come into play?
That was after Al Capone went to prison in 1931. The Outfit is essentially the heirs to his regime. At the time, they were very young, late 20s or early 30s. They were, when Capone was in business, they were his drivers and bodyguards. And when he went away, his operation was called the Syndicate. And when he was in prison, these young men who took over began referring to themselves in private, among themselves as the Outfit. It was never a press thing or anything. It was just the guys themselves began referring to it from 1931 on as the Outfit.
Wow. We're talking with Gus Rousseau, and he's responsible for a book called The Outfit, The Role of Chicago Underworld in the Shaping of Modern America, published by Bloomsbury. Mr. Rousseau, let's talk a little bit about the heyday of organized crime and the rise in particular of this particular faction, namely Al Capone and the group that came to be known as The Outfit. But is that premature? Are there other great giants of organized crime that came before that deserve our notice as well?
Well, the only giants that you hear about regularly are the guys from Chicago, Capone, and very interestingly, The Outfit you didn't hear as much about because their M.O. was to stay out of the press and not to become household words. So many of that's one of the things that attracted me to these guys. They were all powerful, but yet the average person hadn't heard of many of the names that I talk about in the book who ran it.
So much of this is an untold story, in a sense.
Exactly. It's been told in fragments in hundreds and hundreds of books, but never before in one place.
Right.
And one of the most powerful gangsters of all time, a man named Murray Humphreys, who was the brains of the Chicago Outfit, in fact, isn't known to virtually anyone outside of Chicago, but yet for 40 or 50 years, he was probably the most powerful gangster in America and the most influential. But that was his brilliance and the brilliance of this new regime. After Capone went away, the heirs decided we were going to conduct ourselves entirely differently so people don't know our names. And that's what's so, just dramatic about this story.
Hmm. The very specific story you tell in your book, where does it begin? When and where does it begin?
Well, I have a prologue that goes into sort of ancient history about the origins of Chicago and criminality there in general and the bootlegging days of Al Capone. But the book kicks off, part one really starts with The Outfit after that all happened. So 1931 is when it really starts.
Right. So it's really with the imprisonment of Al Capone, in a sense, that your specific story begins.
Exactly.
Let's backtrack for just a second. Can you tell us a little bit about how Al Capone rose to the prominence that he did? How did that happen?
Well, Capone, as with many of the Chicago gangsters that followed and preceded him, originally came from New York. I talk about this New York to Chicago gangster pipeline. When gangsters got in trouble with infighting in New York, they'd go to Chicago, of course, because there was no police and they have free run of the city. So a number of the founders of this syndicate in Chicago were from New York. And essentially the way they got started was not very subtle at all. It was just out-and-out warfare. It was the survival of the fittest. He was a tough, ruthless guy. And he beat down his opposition for the brass ring of bootlegging. And so it was just bloody warfare, and that tailed off quite a bit after his regime was over. But the 20s were, it wasn't about, and also, I want to backtrack, it was also about paying off politicians. Capone was smart enough to know that if you owned the mayor, that things would be a lot easier. So they really began to get into political corruption.
Al Capone was imprisoned in 1931. What allowed that to happen?
Well, that's a good question because most people, the Bible on this is that that happened because the city was just so tired of his wanton criminality, and certainly there's truth to that. Also, the city was trying to give a better image for itself. It was trying to bring in more out-of-town business, banking investments, and so forth. The World's Fair was coming in 1933, and Chicago really wanted to clean up the streets. So the founders, the city fathers got together and really put the pressure on Washington to crack down on Capone, which they did. But what makes that question even more interesting is there's an underlying story here about the possibility that the gang themselves cooperated in putting Capone away. There's no proof of this, but it's certainly something you hear from the old-timers, and that is that Capone was so flashy and so over-the-top, so violent, that it was to everybody's best interest that he go away, And as a matter of fact, they probably could have fixed his trial and gotten him or paid his back taxes, which what he was in prison for. But people let him go. His own people, I think, were happy to see him go so the new regime could take over.
Wow. It made life simpler for them and for the syndicate.
Exactly. I think they just saw that Capone was out of control. He had just outlived his usefulness in setting up this whole network, and it was time to move on to a more enlightened gangsterism, so to speak.
Wow. Well, that's what we want to explore now. One of the things I want to ask you about is how organized was this organized crime? What kind of hierarchy are we talking about? And we're talking about people who actually had what we would think of almost as specific offices or very specific delineated duties, and how stable a structure are we talking about?
Well, the Chicago variation of organized crime was amazingly stable, unlike New York, which always made the front pages for intergang assassinations and probably still does. You were always seeing on the streets of New York or in barbershops or restaurants, you know, leaders getting blown away. But the Chicago variation was incredibly stable, and that's why it ultimately became so successful. What was so fascinating to me was in doing the research was that these guys decided we were going to look like and act like upper world corporate leaders as much as possible. And that means we wear suits and ties, we don't drink, we don't chase women, we work 9 to 5, if not more hours, we have a regular meeting place, and everybody better do his job or they're out. They had business plans, they had long-term plans, they had short-term plans to expand the empire, and they went about it extremely methodically. It had to do with paying off politicians, putting people in a position of power that they could later manipulate, seeing where the next nest egg was going to be for to make their fortune. They were always talking about what the new booze was going to be after Prohibition. They needed a new booze, and they had a lot of foresight. They were constantly predicting what was coming, and they methodically planned how to attack it.
So this was actually a rather tidy organization.
Yes,
tidy and efficient,
mm-hmm.
and put together much like a corporation might be. When you talk about that they had business plans plans and schemes, what sorts of tangible activity are we talking about where they would secure these fortunes for themselves?
Well, let's see. A good example would probably be when they wanted to build Las Vegas. Of course, the Chicago gang really founded Las Vegas, which is now, of course, the fastest-growing city on the planet. And that was their vision from day one. And to do that, they, of course, had to come up with just lots of money to build these resort casinos. Now, they had the money. They had the cash because they were making it off of gambling, and they had money from bootlegging still. But they couldn't spend it. It was a weird paradox because if they went and built a $20 million hotel, the IRS would say, where'd you get the money? So they had to come up with a way to make it look like they had borrowed money legally so they could build these hotels, even though they already had the cash. So it was a conundrum, but the way they did it was through a long-term plan. They maneuvered Jimmy Hoffa into the presidency of the Teamsters, and that was done so that they could have access to his pension fund. Once he was in, and that took a number of years to accomplish, once he was in, they waited a couple more years before they made their first withdrawals from the Teamster pension fund, and that's how they built much of Las Vegas. Now, keep in mind, these were legal loans. So when the government would come asking, how could you build the Sands Hotel or whatever, they'd say, we took a loan from the Teamsters. Nothing illegal about that. Whereas if they had done it with their own cash, it would have been even worse.
Hmm.
So they took these loans out, all of which, I might add, were repaid to the Teamsters. The Teamsters organization made a fortune off of these guys. These loans were all repaid. They were all legal. But that plan took many years to envision. And initially, even the gang sent couriers out to Nevada in 1931 to bribe the state legislature to pass the wide-open gambling bill. And it took a few years for them to actually move on that, but to actually, you know, jump on it. But eventually they did. So they were patient, and they were methodical.
Wow. Tell us a little bit more about the process of gaining influence and even control over politicians. How was that typically accomplished? And was it as sort of methodical and smooth an operation as it sort of sounds?
Well, the most obvious way, of course, is just pay them. You know, some politicians, the more corruptible ones, are susceptible to just a handout, and then you own them. Others, you have to be more subtle with, and the way to gain their attention is to control much of the labor force, because labor, Teamsters, et cetera, have wide influence over a lot of workers about who they vote for. And so the more indirect way that they usually worked was by controlling the Teamsters and many other labor organizations. They had countless labor organizations, which was part of their brilliance. They realized if we make inroads into labor, everybody will have to deal with us, and that included politicians. So that was the primary way that they got these guys to do their bidding, either by paying them directly in a few cases, or for the most part, just forcing them to come for their power and to make an arrangement with them.
You mean in the sense that if
well,
organized...
Joe Kennedy, for instance, in the 1960 election, when Kennedy wanted the votes that these men controlled, he would come to them, and he did come to them, in my opinion, and basically said, "I want the support you have in about 10 states with all these labor organizations. What can I do for you to get you to vote to work for my son?" And that's essentially what happened in that case.
Hmm. So then millions of factory workers who were part of these labor unions would go to the polls and vote not their own personal preference, but would vote as organized crime directed them, essentially.
Well, and not just directed, but the unions would endorse a candidate, and that was critically important because in the old days, the workers tended to follow who their unions endorsed. And secondly, the unions had the ability to get the vote out. Mm. They would literally drive people to the polls, especially the older workers, the infirm, and that was priceless, especially in an election like 1960 where it was that everyone knew it was going to be a razor-thin margin.
So it wasn't, I characterized it maybe a little more illegal than it actually was, although it pushes the margins of what's really meant to be. When we're talking about control of politicians, are we talking about the very top? Are we talking about the mayors of Chicago?
Oh, without a doubt, and that's widely accepted in Chicago. It's just pure fact that a number of Chicago's mayors were in the pocket of organized crime. They always point to Big Bill Thompson from the 20s as being Capone's mayor, and other ones more or less so. But they really controlled every politician they could get their hands on.
Were there any mayors that sort of eluded that and tried to take a stand against organized crime?
During the heyday of the outfit from 1930 through about, I would say, certainly the mid-60s, because in the 50s and 60s you had Mayor Daley, who notoriously looked the other way at these guys' business. They were virtually unmolested. There wasn't a mayor who was going to take them on for 30 or 40 years. And it wasn't until no mayor ever took them on, as far as I know. The reason they were finally broken up was because of the federal government decided to go after them. But the locals in Chicago gave them a very wide berth.
How about the police in Chicago?
Well, the police in Chicago are historically plagued by corruption at the highest levels. We just saw a couple weeks ago where a former police chief was convicted and sentenced to 16 years for using his position to engineer jewelry robberies for a period of, I think, 15 years or more, and he was the police chief. The police were forever on the payroll of organized crime. Not everyone, of course, but largely that's the case. During Prohibition, the illegal booze bootlegging trucks were very often guarded by moonlighting cops. Capone hired the cops to protect his booze shipments.
Wow.
And so it's an amazing story, typically because the cops are underpaid and the gangsters come along and say, we can offer you extra money. Chicago's always had a problem with its police force.
Yeah. Did anything or anyone ever stand in organized crime's way, in its heyday at least?
Well, there were, you know, certainly the FBI did. That's the fascinating story about why they didn't get in their way. I think what happened was the FBI was too busy with communists and bank robbers to be concerned with organized crime for a number of reasons, not the least of which was that J. Edgar Hoover always prided himself on getting his man. Well, that isn't so easy when you look at something as, you know, ephemeral as organized crime, you know, so vaporous, where it just transgressed all strata of society. These criminals had partners in every part of the country, whether in the corporate world or political world. So it wasn't as easy as going out and arresting somebody. It was opening a Pandora's box that Hoover didn't want to go down. So he didn't want to deal with it, and that was what gave them free rein for a long time. There were here and there an occasional politician who would come along and make a brief stand against them, but totally unsupported by his peers. And Kefauver made a burst in the early, Senator Kefauver in the early 50s, had a big hearing on organized crime, didn't really go anywhere, didn't accomplish anything. Robert Kennedy went after Jimmy Hoffa in the Senate in the late 50s. They eventually got Hoffa, but all in all, wasn't that successful for all the money and time spent on it. It wasn't until the mid-70s that things started to really fall apart. So they had about 40 or 50 years with not a lot of opposition.
Tell us a little bit more about those years, the heyday of the outfit. When you think about them having such unbridled, unrestrained influence over the city, you sort of imagine then that the life in Chicago being just one unrelenting nightmare, which of course it wasn't. I suppose in some ways, oddly enough, life wasn't all that bad. I mean, in what ways was this positive? In what ways was this negative for the run-of-the-mill citizen in Chicago?
Well, this goes to one of the intriguing things that got me to write the book, was that when I go to Chicago and I speak to the old-timers, more often than not, much more often than not, they talk about how they knew these guys and they liked them. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do in Chicago is to find a 75-year-old person who says, oh, yeah, I knew Curly Humphreys or Tony Accardo. Oh, they were great friends. They were terrific. I had one cab driver on a research trip, and he was an elderly man, and we were driving through a slum area, and he was very despondent. He pointed around to all the places where there's drive-by drug shootings every night and cocaine gangs and this and that, and he said, boy, I long for the old days. He said, if the old guys were in control, you wouldn't have any slums like this. They wouldn't tolerate it. And the more I looked into it, what that meant was that the old gangs had a code of some sort, and they preferred order to chaos. And chaos is what you have in a lot of inner-city ghettos, because now you have the drug gangs. And by the way, the guys in Chicago, there was a cardinal rule that you didn't deal in drugs. And there were rules within this structure, and today there are no rules. So life wasn't so bad in the old days, and a lot of people, in fact, prefer the days when these guys were in business.
Wow. Well, who was hurt? I mean, surely there were people,
sure,
people or things or organizations that were hurt, that were compromised in painful ways by organized crime.
Well, that's the interesting thing. In the old days, when they first took over, certainly labor unions were victimized when these men got control of them, and workers' wages were kept down for the most part when they wanted to skim money out of the payrolls of these men. So the workers in the unions were certainly hurt. They weren't, you know, it wasn't like violent, it wasn't horrendous, but they were certainly victimized. Beyond that, the main entity hurt during their reign was the IRS, because the gang's ultimate goal was to steal money that was unreported, and they didn't steal it from home to home. They didn't go door to door robbing people. They just wanted to skim it out of legitimate organizations. Or skim it in Las Vegas, where they would steal money from the count rooms of bettors who already lost anyway, but this money would be unreported. We're talking many millions of dollars. So the big loser was the IRS. These guys weren't robbing banks and so forth, and they would do petty scams like they would sell horse meat disguised as ground beef for a couple of years they had this scam, and but nobody actually got sick. It wasn't in the old country they did this all. People ate horse meat all the time, so they didn't think it was a big deal. It's just a scam, and, you know. And it was funny because the people of Chicago ate this for about 2 or 3 years before they found out about it. I mean, the best restaurants, and it was just a scam. It was a way to steal money without anybody really being hurt, in their opinion, and nobody was hurt in that case.
Interesting. So a lot of the cost of this, or the pain inflicted, or the cost of inflicted by organized crime, was often rather hidden, kind of nebulous.
I think so, and I think especially when you look at gambling, when they set up bookmaking, you know, who were they hurting directly? I mean, these were people who wanted to gamble, wanted to bet, in fact, wanted to lose their money, it seems like, and these men were saying, we'll take it, you know, and these bettors, when organized crime was diminished, these bettors still exist, but now just different people are getting their money. So the organized crime people, certainly in the outfit, believe that things like booze, everybody wanted, we'll be happy to sell it, and we'll take the money from the IRS. Who's the victim? You know, booze is now legal. Gambling is legal. Off-track betting, formerly known as bookmaking, is now legal. So if there were victims of organized crime in those businesses, those victims are still there, but they just have a different boss. You know, now it's the federal government that runs those operations.
Mm. Wow. Tell us about some of these figures in organized crime. You mentioned that they would be in the office 9 to 5. I mean, a real organized day. Do you mean by that then that this was as close as they had to a job, or were these organized crime figures? Did they actually have other lives with this sort of other life than underneath the surface?
It depends on what tier you're talking about. When you get to the top level, the so-called board of directors, this was their job. They would invariably have something they could say they did for a living by putting in an hour or two at a beer distribution place or whatever, so they could put on their tax forms, I run a beer distributorship. But that was always a front. They would just show up, you know, 1 hour a day or whatever. But the bosses, this was a 9-to-5 job, a full-time job for the bosses. Now, when you get to the lower levels, the men seem to have had, you know, more full-time gainful employment and did it more and more part-time to support the operation. But they always had to find some way to say they had a legitimate job, even if it was only for show. But the main bosses, this was an all-day-long thing.
Let's talk for a moment about 1960 and the election of John F. Kennedy. And it sounds as though you believe, as certainly a number of historians do, that organized crime had something to do with the turnout of the vote in Chicago and the vote swinging as it did for Kennedy. And that was, of course, a crucial ingredient in his narrow victory over Richard Nixon. What do you think the consequences of that were, aside from the fact that Kennedy won? Was there a particular payback necessary, or is it possible to even know?
Yeah, I think we know what happened with that, and there's much new material on that in the book. I think I've taken that about as far as any. Well, I know I've taken it as far as any previous writers, and I think a lot farther with new witnesses and new information. But to answer your question, the underworld in Chicago was told that there would be a payback, that if they helped with the election, that they would get a wide berth in Las Vegas, where they were expanding. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Kennedy brothers didn't make this arrangement, so they didn't have any payback to worry about. It was the father that, by all accounts, was going around making these deals, which is an astounding story in itself, that he would run around the country, and I have numerous new witnesses who talk about him going to Florida, meeting with Meyer Lansky's people, going to Chicago, meeting with the outfit people, without his sons being in on the plan.
Wow.
So whereas the gang thought they were going to get some arrangement, the boys never believed it, never would have done it. So it put them in an incredible tenuous position, as you can imagine, when the gangster says, where's our deal? And the Kennedy boys, you know, basically, what are you talking about? We're coming after you.
Well,
and the gang felt double-crossed.
Of course. Plus the fact that Joseph Kennedy ends up having a debilitating stroke
Exactly.
Fairly early on. I mean, that's while his son is still president, I believe, right?
Correct. In 1961, I believe, or 62, 61, I believe the stroke was. And, yeah, so the boys were on their own, and especially Bobby Kennedy, who had this high moralistic view of right and wrong, and good and evil, and he just saw these men as devil, the devil incarnate, even though they were friends of his father's for many years. He took off on them, and the men in Chicago are scratching their heads saying, wait a minute. Now, some people have taken that to mean that, therefore, organized crime killed President Kennedy to pay back for the double cross, but that didn't happen. There's no evidence that they would do anything or did do anything like that. But what they did do, interestingly, I point out in the book, they sabotaged the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was so important to President Kennedy and hurt his entire administration and crippled it, in my opinion. But that was, I think, a largely result of the fact that the outfit cut the legs out from under that operation by pretending they were going to kill Fidel Castro. They were enlisted, by the way, the outfit was, to kill Fidel Castro concurrent with the invasion. But after Bobby Kennedy was appointed attorney general, these guys said, well, let's just play the ultimate trick on these guys. We're going to sabotage the whole thing. We're not going to kill Castro. Let them think we are. So when Castro doesn't die during the invasion, of course, the invasion is total disaster. And that destroyed Kennedy. So they got even in a way.
That changed everything.
Changed everything, yeah.
Wow. Is that part of the story behind this other book you wrote called The Secret War Against Castro and the Death of JFK?
Yeah, the first book takes up from that point in the sense that the next 3 years or 2.5 years of Kennedy's term, he had to deal with the repercussions of losing the Bay of Pigs operation, which ultimately resulted in sabotage, hidden secret sabotage that the Kennedy brothers had to wage against Cuba, and it infuriated people like Lee Harvey Oswald. And so in an indirect way, the outfit was responsible for what happened in Dallas because they created the atmosphere that Kennedy had to go all out to get Castro, therefore inspiring Lee Harvey Oswald, who killed him.
We're speaking with Gus Russo, the author of The Outfit, The Role of Chicago's Underworld in the Shaping of Modern America. Mr. Russo, do you have time for a couple more questions?
Sure.
I want to take us further into the 1960s and we have already touched on, of course, a very, very familiar name, and that is of the longtime mayor, Richard Daley, not the current Mayor Daley, but his father. And what are the ways in which he was a figure of cooperation with organized crime?
That has been largely exaggerated about the Daley's connection to organized crime. Certainly every mayor in Chicago had to look the other way with these guys because they controlled so much of the infrastructure of the city. Daley was never a gangster. He never profited, in my opinion, from gangsterism. What he did do was have a laissez-faire attitude to these guys because he realized, like the old cab driver I was telling you, that in some ways, these men were predictable, and they weren't destroying the city. And in fact, a lot of people understood how to deal with them and liked them. The crimes they were committing were largely crimes against the federal government, and
not so much against the city or
exactly,
its citizens.
Exactly, yeah, or its citizens. Yeah, and I think that Daley said, "Well, let the feds deal with it if they want to." These guys I've used them when I've needed them for help, and they, you know, and I'm not going to get in their way. He also, I think, realized, and other scholars have talked about this, that Daley realized that what the gangsters were doing was trying to move into the upper world themselves to a more legitimate lifestyle, and this was sort of a ungraceful transition process, and eventually they were going to become owners of big corporations themselves, and so it was an ethnic succession sort of thing that some people believed was going on, and I think Daley was one of those people.
Interesting. How does the matter then begin to end for organized crime?
Well, eventually, of course, by the 70s, a couple of the leaders of the outfit had passed on, so by definition, it was starting to fall apart. And also by the 70s, there was a crackdown on crime after the certainly the Law and Order campaign of Richard Nixon. You started to see new laws come on the books that allowed the federal government for the first time to prosecute and to investigate the interstate connections of the Chicago Outfit and the New York gangsters. So they were able to break up the global aspect of it. And the most obvious example is what's called the RICO laws that came in the 70s, which gave the weapons to the federal government to break up interstate racketeering. And so for the most part, the government eventually became successful in at least getting rid of this one segment of organized crime, and the gang from Chicago either died off or receded, you know, back to just the Chicago region. It wasn't a national concern anymore.
So it's not that organized crime vanished from the streets of Chicago, but that its far-reaching influence was pretty much crippled.
Exactly. And the crime you have now, that in Chicago, there was a recent article in Chicago Magazine where they referred to what you have now as mob light, you know, just a small, streamlined, almost going back to the pre-Prohibition days, where they go in the traditional things of local gambling and construction unions and so forth, but the vision and the adventurousness of the old gang is gone.
One of the names you had mentioned was that of Humphreys, Murray Humphreys.
Right.
What became of him?
He had died of natural causes in 1965. He had a heart attack, but he was under great pressure at the time. The FBI was trying to arrest him for questioning, and he actually just got super excited, and he flipped out. He just lost control, and he was wrestling the FBI agents in his apartment. He went down and was arraigned and was released. He went back to his apartment and had a heart attack. So he was, but he had a history of heart trouble for probably 10 years up to that point.
You said that he was quite an effective leader of the outfit, and by and large, were there effective leaders in the group? I mean, in other words, did people who knew how to lead become their leaders, or was there did there have to be a number of ineffectual figures sort of taken out of their positions, or did that not happen too much?
Well, essentially, the way it worked was the effective ones did rise to the top, like in any other organization, I think. And but what's most interesting about the way these guys presented their operation was they had what you would call a front man or a street boss who would be the day-to-day operator, but who wouldn't be the real power. And that was one of the interesting techniques and strategies they came up with. It started in the 30s with Frank Nitti, who was the boss of Chicago, but in reality, he had a board of directors he had to answer to. But he served the purpose of being a flak catcher. Should something go wrong, he would be arrested. The same happened in the 50s and 60s when the gang put up Sam Giancana, who's a pretty well-known name. But interestingly enough, the way it was structured, Giancana ultimately had to answer to the real bosses, which were these hidden guys who didn't want their names in the paper. But anything big, Giancana had to go to them for is it they're okay, vis-a-vis the 1960 election. When Joe Kennedy met with Giancana, he had to go back to these four or five guys, and they had to vote on it and tell Giancana whether he could do it or not.
Hmm.
So that's the way their leadership worked.
Wow. And it worked well.
I think so.
Wow. One last question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really fascinated to know a little more about how you went about researching this. And I'm particularly intrigued by when you mention visiting some of the old-timers, as you call them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking sometimes about just older citizens of Chicago who were not a part of organized crime, but I assume at some point you have also had conversations with those who were involved in this.
Yes, I did. Now the main four or five leaders of the outfit are all passed on, so I obviously didn't have a chance to meet with them, but I did speak with people who knew them, who worked under them. I did speak with one giant of organized crime who nobody had spoken with before, and that was Meyer Lansky's lifelong partner, Jimmy Allo, who knew well the situation with Chicago and knew them intimately, and he just passed away recently. but he gave me a series of long interviews. How do you go about it? I think first you start off by reading all the literature that precedes you. Then the next thing I usually do is write letters to people mentioned in those books and so forth, and write letters to the federal government requesting files, especially from the FBI. I file Freedom of Information Act requests almost instantly when I start a new project, and I got the files on a number of these guys, massive files in some cases, thousands of pages. I got people like Capone's file and Humphrey's and Accardo's, and you just get a basement full of documents. And that's how you start. You know, you get all the names under your belt, and then you go out looking for the people who still survive, and you write them letters.
I'd almost envisioned you hanging out at the corner barber shop just waiting for colorful figures to show up. That doesn't work that way.
It'd be nice, but if you did it that way, it would just take forever, so you have to be much more aggressive and find them and go after them because there's no time to wait.
Right.
I had 18 months to do this book, and I wish I'd had 5 years.
Sure. Well, and it sounds like it's a good thing you were able to sit down with Jimmy Allo, for instance, before he passed away. Now, why would someone like that sit down, or was it with any reluctance that he sat down with you to talk about his past?
Well, it was with some reluctance. I had to convince him of what I had done before, that I was honorable, that I hadn't misled people in the past. And he was very specific. He said, I'll talk to you about certain things, but there's certain things I won't talk to you about, when he finally agreed to talk at all. And I said, well, I'm interested in 1960. I wasn't doing a book on Meyer Lansky or the New York gang, so he was, I think, put at ease by that. I was doing a book about Chicago, so he was much more comfortable in talking about that sphere, which didn't directly involve him. But he knew a lot about 1960, for instance, because, in fact, according to him, Joseph Kennedy came to Meyer Lansky first. He and Jimmy Allo were met by Joe Kennedy in Florida, who asked for their help in the 1960 election, and they turned him down. And so there were a number of really interesting insights. He talked a lot about the murder of Bugsy Siegel, which at the time I didn't have all the pieces, so I didn't put it all in the book, but I had a good part of it because, of course, Bugsy was Meyer's longtime friend and associate, and there were rumors that Lansky had killed Siegel and so forth, and he gave me the inside. Allo did, because he was with Siegel for the whole thing.
Wow.
So things like that he was willing to talk about.
Interesting. Does your book end up, to any extent, glorifying organized crime?
Well, it certainly can be taken out of context to say I'm taking it easy on them, because I knew it was dangerous that way going in, because I wanted to present these people as human beings, not as cartoons, which for the most part they have been presented as.
Right.
Because when I come to Chicago, I invariably hear from people about how gracious they were. So it's impossible to, if you're going to be honest about this, to call them evil monsters, because the people in Chicago said they weren't. So I wanted to figure that out. And in doing so, I think people are going to say, oh, you can't do this. They were all evil, and you're glorifying what they did. I'm just trying to understand it in the perspective of the times. How bad were they? What was the truth about how evil they were? What I found was there have been a lot of exaggerations. They weren't as bad as they were made out to be, because a lot of that is done for political reasons. If a congressman wants to become president, he goes on a tirade against organized crime. And, so I also pointed out that the way these men rationalized what they did was by merely pointing to white-collar crime and corporate crime, which massively dwarfs what the underworld ever did. And that's how, and all I say is that, look, if you want to get serious about crime, why do we constantly go after the John Gottis of the world, which, should be done to some degree, of course, but John Gotti is really not a front-page story in perspective. John Gotti should be page 30. Page 1 is what the corporations have been doing to this country since day one and getting away with it in spades and thereby providing inspiration and rationalization to lesser criminals. And until you take that away, you can't be hypocritical about it.
Writer Gus Russo, in an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2002. The book again is titled The Outfit, The Role of Chicago's Underworld in the Shaping of Modern America, published by Bloomsbury. Gus Rousseau's other books include Live by the Sword, The Secret Life of Castro and the Death of JFK, and Brothers in Arms, The Kennedys, the Castros, and the Politics of Murder, and a book he co-authored with NBC's Tom Brokaw called Where Were You? By the way, the outfit went on to be nominated for a